For about 15 years of my life, I sat most of the time in a rather small room that had two, maybe three chairs in it, in which people shared with me the agonies of their existence. The process was probably something you might recognize as psychotherapy. You can't do that for that length of time without learning something. And towards the end of that period, I had an opportunity to sit down for a while and just think about what I had learned. And I think some people thought a book was going to come out of it, but something came out of it that you could put on a blackboard very easily. Just a few words and a few ideas that I think are important enough to try to hang on to. At least that's all I learned, but what I did learn I think is important from these people. They, in the process, they spoke, of course, eloquently of their agony. The agonies of man come out in a lot of different ways, and only some of them are the kinds of things that I was dealing with in that room. They also come out physically and in other ways. The other day we were talking, a week or so ago, I forget, lost all track of time up here now, but a week or so ago I was quoting an acquaintance of mine, Dr. Reinierson, who at the time that I knew him was the chief of medicine at Mayo Clinic in Rochester. And I was putting on some sort of a seminar at the time for doctors and pastors and psychiatrists. And I had Reinierson speak, and he was a brilliant fellow and one of the most renowned men in internal medicine in his day. And he, this was, say, 20 years ago, maybe 25 years ago now, but we were having breakfast one morning before one of his lectures, and he said that he thought that he probably told more people than did any other doctor in the world that they either had or had not cancer. Now, if you think back 25 years to the nature of Mayo's at that time, you know that it was kind of the end place. That means that there was a different patient population, substantially different, than you'd find in most other places and most other clinics. I told him I didn't envy him. To have to tell so many people that they had cancer must be a dreadful thing. And I asked him why he did it. Why not, spread that out among many people? He, as the head of the department, reserved for himself the right to report on the findings of all the people in his staff and to break the news. Well, he said he thought that maybe his years of experience made him a little bit more qualified to do it, but he said it isn't telling people that they have cancer that gives me the problem. It's telling people that they don't have cancer that's the problem. Because that is the one in which you see the raw anguish. Well, of course, I asked, like you were undoubtedly asking, how can that be when they get the good news? But it wasn't the good news for them. Now, keep in mind, this is where the difference comes in that population going to Mayo's at that time. They'd been to everybody else first and were sure they were sick, as indeed they were. And the hometown doctor said, I can't find anything wrong with you. So then they would go to the nearest clinic that had a name or a reputation and say, my hometown doctor can't find anything wrong with me, but I know I've got cancer. I must have cancer. Meaning that it was a deduction that they made, using must in that sense. What Reinierson had discovered was that they must have it, that it was an imperative that they have it, as the only way that they could explain the degree of agony and anguish that they had. Well, they'd work their way through the university clinics, then. It's a reputation clinic couldn't find it. And the university clinic couldn't find it. Then in some kind of anger and in desperation, they'd say, well, I'll go to Mayo's because there surely they can find it. And they looked back in some hostility at the ineptitude of the medical profession that hadn't been able to find their cancer, because they knew they had it. And in many of these people, the agony was focalized into a pinpoint of pain. Why do I constantly have this pain, just like my dad did before he died? You know, right here, I'm sure I've got stomach cancer. And when they couldn't find an organic basis for the pain, and then came to Mayo's, now hoping that here they could find it, because you can't live in that kind of an agony without having it named, identified and named. And then when he would say, we have found nothing organically wrong with you, you do not have cancer, that we can tell you with a high degree of certainty. Then, he said, you had to stand by to pick up the pieces. And that's why he happened to be willing to lecture to this particular group, and it was the theme of the seminar that we are having, of how then do you move in to help people. Now, some things that we've learned much since that day have been, or mostly since that day, have shown that you can influence the way in which tissues behave themselves. You can modify the chemistry of the body by some of the fears and the anxieties that we have. And right now, the very latest thing that's happening in some circles is a close look at the nature of the cell. It was thought that, and has been believed all the time, and everybody, I think, quotes, knows that the cell has a skin around it, a membrane-like thing that has pores in it of varying sizes depending on the cell and its function and its environment in the body. And it's always been thought that the size of those pores determine that they function like a filter, a screen, let certain things in and certain things out. Most cells function as a chemoelectric system. As for instance, the heart, when it beats, fantastic operation, that pump. It's only recently, in the last, what? Well, you know Ed Humphrey, Molly.
Yeah.
Ed's the guy that discovered this. Ed discovered that how the heart beats, precisely how it beats, and the pacemaker and all that stuff grows out of this kind of work. Ed Humphrey is a great surgeon, professor at the University of Minnesota, and the president of the congregation that Molly and I belonged to at one time together. Mm-hmm. But Ed went on quietly in his very humble way and took a PhD in physiology while he was on a full schedule as a professor and a great surgeon, and discovered just exactly what the physiology and anatomy of a heartbeat is. I don't know how many billion of these things take place by the time you get to be 3 score years and 10 or whatever it is, or 4 score and 10. Well, what happens is that through these tissues, these cells, there leaks out of the cell potassium, and into it goes sodium, or the other way around. I don't know anything about these things. And when that happens, that ion exchange, a little charge of electricity builds up in each of these zillions of cells. And as this charge builds up, it gets to the point where it's almost ready to explode or discharge, spark off, you know, spontaneously. Now, if that would happen, the heart would go blip, 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 like this, you know, and we call that fibrillation. But it doesn't pump when it goes like this. It's got to go. That's the way it pumps. But when it goes like this, then you're in trouble. That's what Ed is trying to find out. How do you get it out of fibrillation? And how do you maintain its rhythms? Well, God put into one little part of the heart a place where the probably the pores were bigger, if you're taking the old idea of the cell. It may still be right. It may not be. But some little part of the heart, this thing happens faster, and when that sparks, it sparks off the whole heart. And that's how you get a controlled beat instead of every cell popping off the way it wants to. Because in this one section, this takes place a little bit faster. There's a little bit more electricity built up at that part of the heart, and they spark off and the whole heart clamps down. And that's been happening, 100 times since we started talking about it just now, huh? And it just keeps on going that way, and with fantastic regularity, in spite of the fact that every once in a while you might skip one or two and it doesn't make any difference at all, and every once in a while it goes a little bit faster, and you go up to Heart Lake, it goes a lot faster if you're my age. You know, well, it's a fantastic instrument. But now they're discovering something about the tissues around there, and I'd like to talk to Ed to see if this modifies anything at all in what he was doing. Now they think that maybe it isn't the skin. The new, very high-powered electron microscopes say that maybe it isn't the skin. Maybe it's just a kind of a field. And maybe there isn't really porosity. That is, certain gauge holes through which things go in or out. Now, connected with that is the interest in the simultaneous and rather dramatic increase in two diseases. Hypertension, and that doesn't mean just getting nervous. There's more to it than that. It's the whole big disease thing with very high blood pressures. Hypertension, which is probably the fastest growing disease we have in America today, and cancer, which is probably the next fastest growing disease that we've got. And the concomitance of these two has raised the question, is there any relationship? Now, concomitance doesn't prove relationship, but it always suggests it. Two things happen at the same time, you say, hey, how did that happen? And one of the ways it may happen, and that's what sparked off a lot of new interest in the nature of the cell, is a question of whether it modifies the chemoelectrical field, and particularly this definition of the cell, this outside of the cell, this membrane, if it is a membrane. And in doing so, modifies and reduces the immunological mechanisms of the human body. Now, if they should discover that that is true, and in somewhat the way that I've suggested as a possibility, and that a lot of research people are going after today, they still won't have the cause for cancer. Everybody wants to do things the simple way, always. It's just our natural tendency to say, oh, that is the cause, or that is the answer. And if there's anything that science has proved, it is that there's multiple causation for almost everything. And as soon as you say you have the answer, you've walked into a trap and have suckered into something. There's an old professor of psychotherapy in a Viennese medical school years ago. He used to come in and write on the board every day, S=9. And in the formality of those classes, the students never asked him what it meant, because they knew that if he wanted them to know, he'd tell them. He'd walk into the room, they'd stand stiffly, click their heels. He'd say, good morning, gentlemen, you may be seated, and they would be seated, and everybody would hit the chair at exactly the same time, and they would listen. He'd write S=9, go on a lecture, never mentioned this, and the whole term went through. Never touched it. The last day, he quit 5 minutes early, and he said, gentlemen, it has been good to have you in class. Thank you for listening so attentively and so courteously. And he bid them good day, walked to the door, and then said, oh, yes. Just by chance, maybe somebody has wondered what S=9 means. Well, he wasn't really S=9, but that's the closest we can come to it. Well, he said, S, that means the situation or the problem, the predicament. It equals 9. Why does it equal 9? Because 9 is the most complex of all problems, of all numbers. The very least it is 9. But it can be fantastically beyond that. in its complexity. It can be the result of addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, or combinations of all of them. But, and it may be all that, but the very least it is 9. And gentlemen never forget it in the Orthodox. You know, it'd be good to have him around, I think, to remind us. Well, now this is true in human illness. If there's anything that the last 10 years has brought into the forefront and consciousness of therapists of one kind or another, it is that S=9, however it's expressed. Multiple causation. One of the reasons for this should have been apparent long ago, and it should have been Christians who stated it. Because biblical anthropology, that is the biblical definition of what a human being is what we're just catching up to, and the biblical anthropology says man doesn't have a soul. The Bible never said that man has a soul. It simply says he is a soul. It doesn't say that man has a body. It simply says he is a body, among other things. That man is body. He is spirit, which is probably a better word in this case than soul. He is emotions. He is relations. He is mind. All of these in inseparable and constant dynamic interaction with each other at every moment of his existence, whether sick or healthy. And when something affects the human being, it affects the totality of him and not some fraction of him. Now, we still get caught up, I think, in this divisibility, and we still go ahead kind of believing that man has a soul that is some fraction of him. Read your Bible. If you want to read the old King James, and it doesn't make any difference if you read the more modern version, they may use different words, but it says the same thing. The word that we draw soul out of is nephesh kaya. And in Genesis it says that God decided to make us in his image. And he formed us out of the dust of the ground and breathed into our nostrils the breath of life. And so man became a living soul. And how many years have we read that man got a soul in that process, was given one? It just doesn't say that. It just doesn't say it. It says he became a soul. Nefesh kaya. When they translated scripture, you know, in some of these newer translations, they ran up against the problem, and the translators really had a headache because they couldn't use the word soul, because everybody had informed the word soul with a different kind of a meaning as a fraction of a human being, not a word for what he is. So they had to drop the word soul, and then they got into all kinds of mess. And, well, they say that man is a living being, which is a lousy kind of an expression for the richness of that nefesh kaya, this unique being whose name is Adam. He was brought up out of the stuff of the ground. That's Adama. His name is Adam because he was pulled up out of this, drawn, formed out of this dust of the ground, and then breathed into and became this fantastic, unique being, which we are. Well, so many things affect what goes on within that cell. And God made every one of them, and all the molecules, and all the chromosomes, and genes, and all the chemistry of the whole business, and set these fantastic systems at work within us. He's the God of the molecules. I'm so conscious of this because spending almost all my life in hospitals, I both stand in wonder at the way in which God heals people by the thousands, routinely, kind of. And we take it all for granted and don't very often sing the doxology even. Anyhow, and the other thing, I just get mad. Because We so seldom raise our voices in praise mm-hmm. for the God who has made it all.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
And if it happens to come that Mary Hinderly gets such tremendous relief from one of the new drugs that has been mined up out of God's storehouse, we say, well, science is wonderful, isn't it? That's God's usual way of healing. Now, when the pains of man's existence come, that isn't where I'm supposed to be writing this. Let's start with the word pain. Everybody has pain. From the moment you're born, you have pain. And it never stops. Every moment, everybody in this room right now has pain. I'm trying to define what I mean by pain. I bet if I asked how many of you were in pain, only a few of you would say you were. A little bit later on, you know, when an hour's gone by on some of these harder chairs, all of you would. But right now, very few would. But if you stop for a moment to reflect, there's some kind of something less than perfection in the moments that we exist, huh, right now. There is something less than perfection. We're not capable of perfection. Since the fall, there is no moment that can be called perfect. Unless you want to use some extreme language and say we've had a perfect day. It's a way of saying thank you or something, huh? It isn't a statement of fact, because there is no perfection that's possible anymore. There won't be until that great day. So we live in imperfection. We have to live even confronted with chaos, in which bad things happen to good people and some good things happen to bad people. And some of it doesn't make any sense at all. But that's part of what the fall means in our existence and in our predicament. But at the very least, it has introduced into every moment a deficit. I am a little bit lonely, or I've got a sore toe, or a toothache, or a stomach ache, or that hip is kicking up a fuss again on me. It did today. Or I have some ambitions, or some aims, or some hopes that aren't quite fulfilled. Or I am aware of somebody's ache or somebody's pain. I guess I wouldn't want a perfect moment if I stopped to think of it, because it would have to mean then I was detached from my fellow man. Huh? How can you be in such perfect bliss if you're a part of the human race, with its rather widespread agonies and sufferings? How can you be acquainted with Jesus and know anything about what the cross meant at a specific day and hour, and what that cross continues to mean as it operates within human existence and the human predicament? All right, so there's pain of some kind or another, always, constantly. It's only relatively less or more. The fact of it is always there. And it operates in the cells of our body, and in the bones, and in the nerve endings, and it operates in the thoughts we have, and in the emotions. It operates in the kind of thing that Reinerson was talking about, where it would be better to have the amount of agony explained by having cancer than to let it dangling out there without explanation and without name. If it hurts that bad, surely somebody must have a name for it. Now, some of the things that I learned from these people. Anybody who has pain also experiences a concomitant fear. You're not going to be able to read the writing, but believe me, that's what I'm writing. Fear. Always. As soon as you have pain, you have fear. It is a part, almost, of the same thing. The reason for it is that God put it there. God gave us the capacity to feel pain, and God gave us the capacity to feel fear, and you better sing the doxology if you can feel pain and if you can be afraid. If you can't, you're going to be dead soon. Because these are warning systems that are established within the human being. They're signals. They must be there. Yes?
I just want to add something. I hope you don't mind.
No.
Quite a few years ago in Boise, we had a wonderful little old man that spoke that had been helping in Blackfoot with the mental patients. She was about 70. And I'll never forget her because she tripped into this room, kind of back to those steps, and she played the piano. She said, "We have found that music is one of the things that brings out the cause or whatever or however that has teared off this mental illness." And she sat down and played. And she played beautiful. Little old lady just playing all over the piano. It was really beautiful, and I never forgot.
Yeah.
And I'm sure she's right. Because something about music brings something out of some people.
But what they get on radio and television that they call music.
Maybe that's doing the opposite, huh?
That's pain. That's fear.
Yeah.
That's pain. When I really meant to say when I started was, when you wrote down fear, there's nothing to fear but fear itself.
Well, let's take a little bit more look at the nature of fear. There's some truth in this, but it's like most truths, we tend to do the same thing as I was saying before in causations. See them in their in singular statement or dimension, and they are. And fear is almost always multiple. Again, I want to get at that now because. Fear, if we just simply use that word, and let me make some definitions for our purposes here. They are technically, I think, probably reasonably accurate, but whether they are or not is not the point. For our communication here, I'm saying that fear is being afraid when you know what you're afraid of. Fear is like when I tripped over on a bank over here the other day on a rocky thing going down to the creek, railroad creek. And when some of those rocks started to move under my feet, I became afraid. And I knew what I was afraid of. I was afraid of rocks bumping me all over and getting hurt. Now, that's fear. There's another kind of fear. It doesn't know what it's afraid of because the causes of it are buried in unconscious mind, and we call that anxiety. I'll write that off on the side here, or at least. Now, anxiety is also fear, but it's a fear that doesn't know, that is consciously, what it's afraid of. This is the one that's bad news. But now, let's hold it for a minute and come back to fear. Gift of God. Doxology. Both of these are signals. Hey, something's wrong. Got a toothache? Do something about it. For the whole tooth is lost, huh? Got a stomachache? Eat different, if that's what's causing it. Or go to a doctor and find out what's causing it. Maybe you got appendicitis, huh? How would you know it otherwise? Well, you might, your temperature may elevate, but that isn't all that uncomfortable, you know? Pain is what says, hey, get going, do something about it. The fear multiplies it and says, do it fast before it gets much worse. That's what the purpose of this is in the relationship. So now you get pain, but it is not only also, it has something added to it, fear, but you have a multiplication factor operating. Fear multiplies the pain you have and says, get going and do something about it. Now, let me explain in a little simple, well, I'll tell you where I learned it. From my son when he was about 2.5 years old. I had taught this before, but I didn't know it. I learned it one day when my son explained to me how it worked by some of his actions. Remember our house in Bloomington? Had a hill in the backyard, steep, went down to the lake or the pond back here. I came home from teaching at the seminary and all dressed up but glad to be home. And went into the house and the front door was kind of open. I knew Gertrude wasn't very far away, but nobody was in the house when I called. Went down the backyard and Davy was there and he was rolling down that hill. It was a rather steep bank and he thought it made great rolling. Went down the backyard and Davy was there and he was rolling down that hill. It was a rather steep bank and he thought it made great rolling. And so he said, came running up and said, Daddy, come and roll. And he looked at me and decided that I probably would roll very well. And I said, oh, no, Daddy's tired or some other phony excuse. Like that. And I remember saying I was tired. I remember also saying that I was dressed up, none of which were the reasons, of course, because I was looking around to see. It got kind of tempting for a minute, you know, but you always got neighbors, you know, and what would they think of the professor rolling down? That's silly. Well, Davy was trying to convince me, and he said, watch, and he down the hill, and he came running up the hill again, and down. But he rolled a little off course and he conked his head on a rock and he hit it and it was hard. And when I saw it, I cringed and I started to move down the hill after that moment of paralysis, you know, when you see something happen, you just stand there for just a second or two, or it seems like an eternity probably. And then when I started running down, but he got up. And when I was halfway down the hill, he was running up the hill screaming like only a 3-year-old can scream. That's the loudest noise known to man outside of what my son puts on his radio at night. But at any rate, I put out my arms because all of a sudden I was filled with some kind of an ache for him and wanted to hold him. He went right underneath my arms and he was screaming, Mommy. And that made me mad because I was available right there. And she isn't the only one that can love a kid, but right underneath. And she heard him 2 houses down where she was having coffee with somebody. And she came running and said, what happened? Well, Davy hit himself hard. And she swoops him up in her arms and sits down in the chair and starts to rock back and forth and say, oh, Mommy loves you. It was sickening. The thing to do at a time like that, as I knew, was to get a cold compress on it and now to stop that swelling from coming up. So I said, get some ice on it right away. And Mommy loves you. You're not doing anything. Why don't you do it? Well, by this time, all kinds of things got all mixed up. Woman, you know, that didn't do the sensible thing. She starts this silly stuff of saying, I love you, to the kid, when that thing was really popping out. Well, partly because of my reaction to the boy and his hurt, partly because I had some awareness that the right thing to do was to get some cold compress on that, and partly because this silly thing that she was doing there, I overstated the ice. I got a Turkish towel and I put ice in it. I would have put that kid in a deep freeze from now on if it hadn't been that when I approached him with this great thing, bag of ice. That's a tough thing about being a preacher, you know. Otherwise, we'd always thought that it wouldn't look nice for a preacher to have an ice bag, I guess. Well, anyway, when I started to approach him with this, he was just squiggling down out of her lap and saying, "I will go and roll some more." But that didn't make sense because I hadn't put the ice on yet. Something was wrong here, you know, because that bump was bigger than when he came in. Pressure. Now, figure it out now. I'm talking about reality. The pressure on those tissues was more, not less. The swelling was greater. That meant nerves were getting squeezed, pinched. But he wasn't feeling it, or not that much. All right, what had happened? Let's just say that we can give numerical values to these things and say that he had, well, this is a pretty good pain. Let's say that he had 10 units of pain. And he had an appropriate, balanced fear response. So we say that was also 10. And 10 times 10, because it multiplies. Just take my word for that. 10. That makes 100. So what he was experiencing here was a total pain of 100. Right. Now, without the ice, there was not much reduction in this. But Mommy had been saying, "I love you," and love always casts out fear. So what we had now was a different kind of a ball game, or at least a different example in arithmetic, because you could take away that 10 units of pain that made him scream up the hill. I mean, just 10 units of fear over there. What he walked out with was 10 units of pain, and nearly anybody can handle the pains of their existence. Did you know that? It's the fear you can't handle that multiplies it and makes it worse. The pain clinics today are discovering that Gertrude did the right thing. And in these pain clinics now, because of the advance of modern medicine, we are creating more situations where people stay alive, even when there is unmanageable and irreducible pain. They have to know how to live with that pain, because the alternative is to give them drugs that would kill them to control the pain. These are rare situations, now keep in mind, but they do exist. And where you have untreatable, irreducible pain, irreducible in the sense that the pain is always going to be there, they teach people how to live with pain and extremely high pain levels, higher than anybody in this room probably has ever experienced, and hopefully none of us ever will have to, and somehow or another still live. And live not only in the sense of existing, but live. Some amazing things are happening. But they happen almost always in a fellowship, in a relationship. And love and affection and concern gets to be an important part. Put that person alone in a room and they'll go screaming into hell of that pain. Now, we have some other kinds of applications and some other kind of problems. Let's say that we have a 10-unit pain of some kind, physical or emotional or whatever. We have a 10-unit pain, but instead of having an appropriate, balanced 10 units of fear, multiplying it up to 100, let's take it different. Let's just say that instead of having 10 units of pain, which is a pretty whopping pain, we've got a 2 unit pain situation. But let's say that instead of having that multiplied now by a little fear, I said, hey, something's wrong, I don't feel very good. You know, that stomach hurts today. Instead of that, all of a sudden, almost panic. Here we go again. 3 weeks ago, I had a pain like this. This has got to be cancer. You know, all of a sudden, rolling up into a big mounting situation where you can only say that the pain isn't that much, but the multiplying factor is by 100 and you got 200 units of pain instead. Now, that really hurts. Now the trick is to find out, where does that come from? Where do you get 100 units of fear when you ought to have had 2, which God gave you in the first place, as part of the protective mechanisms of the body and of the being? Where does it come from? Well, it comes from a kind of a bank account that we tend to keep of a lot of things that we save that shouldn't have been saved. Like old situations that we didn't want to deal with. And we shove them down underneath. Old hurts, old agonies, old guilts, old fears, old hostilities. Some of them dating maybe way back into childhood. Now, some of you may recognize what we're talking about is repression, huh? Yeah.
How does it get connected to the particular number 2 pain? Because why is it associated with that?
Simply because it is demanding expression and explanation. And this is probably it. Now, the reason that cancer very often gets to be associated with this is that that's the worst thing we can think of. And that's why Ranierson was finding so many people, you see, who said, the only way I can explain to myself, these people were saying, they weren't conscious of this perhaps, but the only what they were really saying by their behavior was, the only thing that can explain this enormous amount of fear and anxiety, the technical term for this is, of course, then anxiety, is that it has to be something very great. It has to be. Now, sometimes it is a happenstance. We're never going to get through with this thing today anyway, so let's take a little detour. Many years ago, a psychiatrist referred to me a case of a girl who could not talk. She hadn't been able to talk for 2 years. Unfortunately, the first people who dealt with her said, there's nothing wrong with you. Well, man alive, you know, how stupid can you get if you can't talk? You know, you can't talk. And the psychiatrist got some hints as to the nature of this situation. And because we were well acquainted, he felt that I might be able to handle the situation better than he. Now, this girl couldn't talk, not because there was anything wrong with the nerves or the muscles or the organs of speech, but the whole thing had been shut off. Now, what's the difference? You know, what's caused it? If you can't talk, you can't talk, period. And the real control centers are anyway up in the brain, aren't they? Not down here. That's where the instrument of it is, but the control center is some other place. Now, when we trace back this thing, and it was agonizing work and took a long time, you get an idea of how hard it was, because at first she had to write almost everything, and then I started to understand some of her kind of sounds, that kind of sound that she could get out. And then it made it a little bit easier because she could say yes or no if I made an observation to her. But for the most part, she had to start telling me this. Now, the psychiatrist had said it wouldn't be hard to get her out of this and get her talking, but it's dangerous, and I understood what the danger was. It would have been very easy, I think, for the psychiatrist or for me to have her talking within 3 days or 5 days or something like that. But neither one of us dared to do it. Because what was in operation here was a neurotic crutch. God gives us neurotic crutches. They are not of the devil. They are of God. If we are in danger of collapsing, then God gives us some protection until healing can take place, hopefully. And if the healing doesn't take place or can't take place, at least we got a crutch. Now, anybody who's ever had to use a crutch knows that it's a good alternative to complete immobilization. You're thankful for the crutch if that's the only thing that can make it possible for you to move. And you ought to, you know, sing the doxology over the crutch. The problem is that we very often attribute to the devil the crutch. And say, and in this case, for instance, the fact she couldn't talk was a crutch. It saved her from insanity or extreme physical illness based in what we call conversion hysteria. It has nothing to do with the religious word of conversion. Now, this technical term in psychology and psychotherapy is a term that denotes the taking of the transformation or conversion of an emotional situation into a physical symptom or disease. It's a very common thing. It happens to me about once a month, usually on the day that I have to attend what I always regard as the most boring morning of my life. It's a meeting that I have to attend. I hate it. I invariably wake up with a headache or a cold or a sore throat or something because it helps me out of it. Now, who was it? Was it Disraeli about whom there was first used the term the diplomatic cold? No. It isn't just something that you feign. It's something that happens. No. Now, anyway, this girl had the blessing of no ability to speak. The reason for it was very obvious when we got at all the details. What had happened was this. She had left home to go to the large city to work, not because she wanted to leave the small town in Dakotas or Montana or whatever it was and go to the large city, but because she just couldn't stand it being at home anymore, where her domineering, battle-axe mother was constantly chewing up her meek, kind father. So she'd get alternately mad and angry at the mother who was chewing up the father all the time, or the father who stood there and took it. Well, she told them off, both of them, and screamed at her mother and said she couldn't live in the same house with her anymore, and then screamed at her father and said, why don't you walk out or be a man or punch her or something, you know, and stop this business, but I'm not going to stay here anymore. Well, she walked out, and about 6 months later, she felt so bad about this, she decided she better go home. So she went home, and when she walked in the house, she said, I just felt so uptight about the bad things I said to you when I was here before. I want you to know I love you. But can't something happen so, you know, we can live together in this family in some decency? And the mother said, well, if your father would, you know, take his responsibilities, then maybe I could, you know. And then all off again. And then she said, well, why don't you say something to her? Said to the father. And he said, oh, you know, some things are better just, you know. And then she turned on her mother and screamed at her, and then she said, I've had it. And she'd been in the house less than an hour, and she walked out. And she hitchhiked a ride into the town and caught the train back to Minneapolis. And when she got back to Minneapolis, There was a note under the door saying, call home immediately, and she said, no, she wasn't going to do that. Because she knew it would be her mother screaming at her, you know, for walking out. Or her father saying, oh, please, you know, don't blame your mother so much and come on home. So she just put the note on a table and went to bed and woke up in the morning and went to work. And at night she came home and here this note was there. Well, she thought she'd open it up. She opened up and her mother had died an hour after she left the house. Dropped dead of a coronary. And that ain't good. Just after you told her off. How'd you like to live with that one, you know? The timing was such that there was just no escaping the cause-effect relationship. Her mother had died in the anxiety that was produced and all of the tension that was produced when the daughter told her off. She couldn't escape that. Goodness knows a lot of people had forgiven her before she'd ever confessed it. You know, they said, oh, don't you blame yourself for that now. But how do you get away from blaming yourself? That kind of absolution doesn't do anybody any good. It just causes anxiety. We can repress things by a phony, superficial absolution. And we often do. Without dredging out the muck of it all and bringing it up to be dealt with. Well, all right, if somebody had forgiven her and she had all of a sudden said, fine, I'm free of this, we would have had a worse situation somewhere along the line. That is always predictable. God had prevented her for the moment by giving her a crutch which, you know, shut off her voice and she couldn't say bad things anymore. Well, actually, the way it happened, she went home for the funeral and she threw herself down on the ground in the March or April in the springtime, the melting snow, and they couldn't console her. She was blaming herself for the death of her mother and scratched at the ground and, you know, got herself all wet and muddy and cold and you know, just screaming out in her agony. And she woke up the next day with a cold and laryngitis, and that's a nice little suggestion. Hey, if I had laryngitis when I was home, I couldn't have said things like this to my mother. Now, she doesn't do this consciously, because you can't do this consciously. It is always unconsciously. So, the lack of her ability to speak was the service of the unconscious mind in choosing a way to protect her from the whole impact of this thing for a while by keeping her away from the power of speech, which simply developed more anxiety rather than less, and also added to it a little additional thing that I'm being punished for this. And that made her feel a little bit better. And for 2 years, she couldn't talk. Now, if anybody had unhooked her from this crutch, she could have gone into a psychotic break, unable to handle the terrible trauma of this dreadful experience. Now, it was fun when after 6 months there came the time when this had been looked at and faced by this girl. And she had accepted the guilt that was real in it, but it accepted also the limitations on that guilt, because there were other people involved here that had to share the burden, including her mother and her father. Yeah. But mostly, when she came to realize that God in Christ Jesus was simply wrapping the whole family up in his arms, even the mother now who had gone on, holding her close also. So then one day it seemed time for her to talk. And so I told her, today is the day you must talk. What would you like to talk about? And she said the Lord's Prayer. She wrote it out on a piece of paper and we got down on her knees and we started. And at first there were just some honking sounds coming out of her throat as I slowly prayed with her the Lord's Prayer. But somewhere is along the line, forgive us our trespasses As we forgive those who trespass against us, the words got clear. And then she prayed to be delivered from evil. And when the glory part came, and the power part came, and the forever and ever part came, it was in clear voice. And it took about 4 days until that girl's voice was back to where it belonged. It's the first time I've ever told this in public. The very first time. Let me explain why. And I bind you to some kind of a contract with me now. That this is nothing to be talked about. It can be so easily misunderstood. You can talk about it, I guess, in appropriate circumstances. If you say that there were 6 months of very hard work to get at the roots and not simply relieve her of the symptom and leave the cause which would have destroyed her. It would have been such an easy thing to detach her from this and make it possible for her to talk. The psychiatrist was a wise psychiatrist and realized that if he did this without taking her through the route of a thorough examination of what was involved, a deep and profound experience in confession and an absolution that was based on the realities of the situation, that without that, we would have contributed to an increased bank account of garbage down in here, which could destroy her the next time any little problems came up. We'll get into some of that more tomorrow, because I have to hasten on this.
Oh, could I just, at this very point, make a suggestion that anybody that's interested in this kind of thing, I read a marvelous book called No Language But a Cry. Are you familiar with it?
No, no.
It's about a child abuse case history. And it sounds as if it would be a morbid thing to read, but it left me feeling very hopeful for the possibility.
All right, what's the title again, Molly?
No Language But a Cry.
No Language But a Cry.
I'm sorry, I can't think of the author right now.
No Language But a Cry.
But it's a doctor, it's a psychiatrist who got involved with an orphan child who had not spoken for 12 years. She was 12 years old, and she had been abused as an infant. He worked with her until she was 18 years old. It took that long. But the working through, it's a case history, and the working through of it is reads, it's very exciting. It reads like a novel. It's a very short book. It's only about, you know, like half inch thick. But it left me with such a tremendous feeling of the magnificent resources there are in a human that has been that mistreated as that baby was, and to be able to come out of that with the help of it. The kind of help she had was surrounded by love of a number of nuns in a New York orphanage, and with the help of this very understanding psychiatrist.
One of the reasons that I, with this particular girl, was very conscious of the dangers of doing anything that would get her to talk prematurely and before this thing had been resolved, so that she didn't need the crutch anymore. The point I'm making is, don't take away the crutch when the need of the crutch is still there, because you simply grab another crutch or dive into the oblivion of psychosis. But one of the reasons was that I'd attended some meetings at the fairgrounds in St. Paul that Oral Roberts was having. And the activity that I was in at that time was in connection with some clinical pastoral education, I took my students over to see what was going on over there. And the first 6 weeks of that course was in General Medical and Surgical Hospitals of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and the last 6 weeks was out at the Wilmer State Hospital. And two of the people, two men, both of them relieved of their crutches, one of them literally, because he came on crutches, half carried up on the stage, and walked off rejoicing. And the other one with another kind of a disorder, both of them incapacitated when they came up there. And they were that night both relieved of the disorder. But we found them before the end of the summer at the Wilmer State Hospital in a full-blown psychosis, each of them. Mm-hmm. Now, it's true that there were probably 100 people or so that night that were healed in some way or another, or supposedly healed. I guess I'd have to put it in quotation marks. But at least these two did what is the logical conclusion of grabbing the crutch away from a human being and ended up psychotic.
That's why I thought of that book, because that was one of the things he had to do. There's no point teaching her to talk. He had to go through for 6 years and find out what the situation was that brought her to that point.
These are some of the complexities and some of the reasons that the old friend that I never met, that guy that means so much, or has meant so much to me, the fellow who walked in and wrote S=9, you know, has been so useful to me. And I never met him, and of course I never will, because he's long since dead. And now I think that you have a few minutes to wash your hands.
Mm-hmm. May I add one little thing?
Yes, sure.
It comes to my mind. It's a kind of a joke, but it was about a child that wet its pants,
mm-hmm.
and his mother punished it and said, "Why didn't you tell me you had to go?" I don't know if it was both that it did. And the child said, it was supposed to not be able to talk, see, it said, "Because I can't talk."
Yeah, very good.